February 5th meeting of the House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules to Order. Happy Super Tuesday, everyone.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We have one bill before us today, and that is House Bill 3604. So I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3604. And Marjorie, would you tell us about this bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3604 allows chief petitioners of initiatives or referendum petitions to withdraw petitions at any time prior to the deadline for filing that petition.
So, members, that's a brief summary. You'll remember talking about this when the committee requested a draft on this. We do have several documents that you'll see, I think, in your file. There is a letter from Legislative Council. There is a written testimony from Daniel Meek, who emailed comments to us. And is there anything else in the file at the moment?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you do have a piece of testimony from Margaret Olney, who has signed up to testify.
Right, and I see that she's in the audience to testify. So, why don't we, since she's the first person signed up, why don't we call her forward? Good morning. Thank you for being here. I know that from trading phone calls, you scrambled to get here today, so we really appreciate you fitting this hearing in.
It's my honor, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. My name is Margaret Olney, and I'm an attorney here today on behalf of SEIU. I do a fair amount of election law on behalf of public sector unions and nonprofit agencies. I've most recently been involved in the Basic Rights Oregon litigation on the domestic partnership bill and the referral, and that actually does inform my analysis of this bill. I'm here today to say I think that if the legislature were to pass this bill, it would be inviting litigation. The reason is that under Article 4, Section 1 of the Oregon Constitution that creates the initiative power, I believe that once the signatures are submitted to the Secretary of State under that structure, the initiative process essentially becomes invested in the people. The people is a collective organization, and that at that point it is no longer in the control of chief petitioners. The chief petitioners are shepherds of that process. They have extremely important responsibilities for ensuring compliance with a variety of state law. They may or may not have some kind of protected interest once it gets submitted to the state, but once it is submitted to the state, the Secretary of State, I think, has no discretion on whether or not to validate those signatures and determine whether or not they match those in the voter records and whether or not there's sufficient support to qualify for the ballot. If an initiative is submitted and it doesn't have sufficient support, then chief petitioners can simply determine that they do not want to submit any more signatures and it won't appear on the ballot. But if there is sufficient support, that means that a sufficient number of Oregonians under the Constitution have determined that this should be put to people for a vote. And I think that's the end of the analysis. Any elector under the current statutes, basically any elector who has a complaint about what the Secretary of State has done has standing under, I think it's 246.910, to file litigation to sue, and they would say this needs to be processed. I want to speak to the fact that I think this is a right that is distinct from the right, and I don't know how many of the committee members were following the litigation, the Basic Rights Oregon, but I know that based on the questions I've been asked, there's some sense that Judge Mossman's determination that individual petition signers do not have an individually protected right to have their signatures verified and counted somehow means that the initiative can be withdrawn. It's somehow relevant here, and I think it's really irrelevant. The issue in that litigation was whether or not an individual, when they sign the petition, has an expectation that their signature is going to be verified so that they have a due process right to notice if it has been rejected. So that's all that case was about. In that case, everybody assumed that the Secretary of State had an obligation, had a constitutional responsibility to verify the signatures. And it was simply the question of whether or not the signatures had been appropriately verified that was at issue. I'm aware that Legislative Council has, while acknowledging that there is some constitutional question about this along the lines that I've just outlined and that I've outlined in my comments, that they're suggesting that that this statute be viewed in the context of simply legislation relating to the verification of signatures. And in all due respect, I think that they're just apples and oranges. Whether, you know, chief petitioner withdrawing the petition has nothing to do with whether those signatures are valid. The constitutional deadline that is the triggering event for under this statute for vesting is one that is simply a deadline. And I am sure the Secretary of State, you know, everybody hopes that signatures are going to get in earlier so the process can, verification can start. That deadline is just to ensure that there's an orderly process for ensuring that the verification can happen in time for it to be on the ballot. But I don't think that means that up until that time, it's just a placekeeper. You know, you just get to put it in. Once the chief petitioner puts it in, they have control not to, then it's out of the chief petitioner's hands.
Thank you for your
comments, and certainly this committee is well aware of the litigation over the domestic partnership law, which just took effect on Monday. Congratulations to you on that result, because this was the committee during the legislative session that birthed that bill and brought it to the floor.
And congratulations to the committee. It's an amazing piece of legislation, and I was proud to help defend it. Are there any other questions?
So, Representative Shields, yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Olney, if in the context of, you know, the usefulness of this bill for this session, if we did pass it and the chief petitioner did withdraw one of their ballot measures and then it was litigated over the course of the summer and was found unconstitutional, what would happen to the bill that was pulled back? I mean, the
what would happen?
Initiative petition that was pulled back.
I think the action would be to say that the IP40, if it has sufficient signatures, first that the signatures must be verified under state law, and if it has sufficient signatures, which everybody is assuming that it does, given the volume that were submitted, that it then needs to be placed on the ballot. That would be the result. So it doesn't matter the chief petitioner says, I don't want it. It would be on the ballot because it belongs to the people at that point.
Follow up. And so did I hear your opinion is that any registered voter would then have standing to challenge that?
I believe so.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I had a couple of questions for you. We have the Elections Division in the room, so we can have them come up, and I think some members have requested that. But my understanding is that when there's been a partial turn-in of signatures, that chief petitioners do currently have the ability to withdraw the petition at that point. How do you draw a distinction between, if I'm correct about that, and I see a nod, then how do you draw a distinction between that and what this bill does, which is simply allows withdrawing up to the date where total turn-in is to happen?
I think the key is the partial submission. If it's partially submitted, then it has not yet vested into the people because there isn't sufficient support for it to qualify for the ballot. So the partial submission, it's only going to be, if there's a partial submission, that's by definition because it doesn't qualify. It has not yet qualified for the ballot.
So it sounds like you're saying the point at which it qualifies for the ballot would be the point at which it belongs to the process.
The point at which there are sufficient signatures that would qualify it for the ballot. I don't think that the Secretary of State can sit on his or her hands to say, you know, say, well, it hasn't yet qualified because we haven't verified the signatures. I think that somebody would say, you, Secretary of State, have the responsibility to verify those signatures. And if those signatures are sufficient to qualify for the ballot, then it can, you know, it cannot be withdrawn.
And yes, Representative Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Olney, so what If what you're saying is true, then a chief petitioner would not be advantaged by turning in early petitions. They would wait until the very last minute, dump all the petitions, because there would be no way to back up once they started submitting petitions and reach critical mass. Is that what you're saying?
As a practical matter, the petitioners have to have 100%. Before they can even do a partial, they have to have 100% of the signatures that they need to qualify for the ballot submitted. But that's assuming that's raw signatures. And then back out of that, the number that are going to be invalidated. There's a lot of interest for the chief petitioners to submit those petitions early in order to know how many more signatures they need to get in order to qualify for the ballot, in order to be first in line to get their to get their number first in order to plan their campaigns. The only reason to allow them, their only strategic reason, and frankly, I mean, I don't think it generally comes up after people have spent however much money and time collecting signatures, to be able to withdraw it once it's submitted. It's just, I think this is an unusual circumstance that I haven't ever heard about, and it is unlikely to repeat very often, and there's much more strategic advantage to getting it in earlier so they know what they're doing. And I would say that I was not aware, and we can that the elections division would allow a formal withdrawal of a petition once there's a partial, partial determination. But certainly, it's not vested because it doesn't have enough signatures, and so that as the practical effect is, it doesn't exist.
Okay, thank you. Yes, Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Compare and contrast this with the process used if a candidate for office chooses to file by signature. They go out, gather the signatures from voters, submit those signatures. At that point, even if they had submitted the valid number of signatures of people saying, I want Vicki Berger on the ballot, Vicki then still has the right to withdraw, but under this analysis, it seems like she wouldn't, or at least those signatories would have the right to sue to make her. Is there a distinction there that I'm missing? Why it would the signatures would be different in one case than in the other?
I don't know the deadline for the nominating petition for a candidate to be able to withdraw, and I expect that there is a time beyond which she couldn't withdraw. But regardless, the nominating petition process is one that is a statutory process. The initiative and referendum process is a constitutional process that's established in the Article 4, Section 1. And it says that if a petition is submitted, the Secretary of State shall verify the signatures. I believe that the triggering event is the submission of the petition under Article 4, Section 1. I think it's subsection 4A. I referenced it. And so the Legislative Assembly, So that would be the distinction between a candidate and the initiative process.
Thank you.
Any other questions for this witness? Thank you very much for your testimony. Thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
I do want to clarify for committee members that although some of the comments we are hearing seem to put this in the context of a specific initiative petition, that this bill did not come forward only because of whatever might be going on with any particular initiative. So I think, although you may hear more comments like that, I think when we introduced this, we were just looking at it as an elections bill that might or might not be a good idea. And we're now getting a lot of discussion, obviously, that would indicate that there may be some issues about this that need to be considered. So I just want to make that clear for the record. I think at this point it might be a good idea, although we have another witness signed up to testify, if we do hear from the Elections Division, just to shed a little light on what the current process is and what this proposal would do. Good morning and welcome back.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. John Lindbeck, Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's Office.
I guess I'll probably at this point be best if I just let you ask questions about what it is about the process.
Well, okay, I'll give it a try. I'm not a lawyer, and I didn't go to law school. So I guess first I would just ask you to describe the current process. And you heard me state what I believe to be true, that petitioners now have the ability to turn in part of the signatures that are required and then get a I thought what the way that worked is they get a verification to see how many more signatures they then need to qualify.
Right. It's not uncommon for chief petitioners to turn in signatures early, and we've had some of those this cycle. When time allows, we go ahead and do the normal process that we do, and then pull a sample. Ms. Olney is correct in her testimony in that you have to purport when you're the chief petitioners that you have the threshold number of signatures included in the pool of signatures that you turn in, that you've reached that threshold that is required to qualify for the ballot. You don't have to purport that you'll qualify, but that you've at least turned in that threshold number of signatures. Then we go ahead and sort them, review them for circulator issues, do the statistical sample, and report to the chief petitioners how they did. And then the value of that to the chief petitioners is that when they're short signatures, they know exactly how many signatures they're short, and they have until the July deadline to turn in more signatures in order to meet the required amount and qualify for the ballot. What has happened in the past is if there has been an early turn-in and they change their mind about whether or not they want to go forward, they simply don't turn in any more signatures. We haven't had one, at least since I've been here, where people have turned in the threshold amount, there's been a sample pulled, they've been determined to make the ballot, and then they've asked to withdraw it. What this legislation would do, if I'm reading it correctly, would be allow somebody in that situation to then withdraw their petition. And we have not faced that situation, at least since I've been with the division.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Lindbeck, it's my memory, and I could be wrong, that this legislation was proposed basically by you, sort of in case this happens, because it hasn't happened yet, and there's clarification needed in case it happens.
Yeah, no, we did not propose it. The first I heard of it was Chair Rosenbaum called me and asked me about what we would think of it, and we didn't have any objections to it.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I think the idea had been presented to me by various people, and so I called the Elections Division to just ask them how this would work and what would be an appropriate date to set as the deadline for being able to withdraw.
So then the question for you is, if we didn't have this legislation and it did come forward, what would you do?
I'd call my lawyers. This initiative process, as you all know and can follow just in this cycle, is litigation plagued. And I don't know what would we'd do. We'd look for some advice from the Attorney General's office. We've been faced with this question in the past where with referrals to the ballot, where a city or a county will have referred an issue to the ballot and then they change their mind later, and the city council or the governing bodies wanted to pull it back, and that has also been a difficult issue for us. Legislation that draws bright lines and clear procedures is always welcome as far as we're concerned.
Wait, follow up?
Yeah, follow up.
So what basically this legislation would do would be draw a statutory line.
Correct.
To give guidance to you, that you didn't ask for. However, I'm thinking out loud here because this we've just heard testimony that this is has constitutional issues, so it probably would still be litigated no matter which way we did this.
Based on what I've read in terms of the testimony submitted to you in writing today, it looks that way to me. But it's not a surprise to me either, because it seems like every time I turn around we're getting sued over the initiative process. I mean, it's just the most amazing thing. And I'd love to get out of this cycle, but I don't know how, frankly. It's just turned into such a contentious process. Expensive, too.
I'll let somebody else think out loud for a while.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes, Esther Buckley.
Thank you. Ms. Milk, just to, maybe this is restating again, but if you were faced with a situation today on the current law, and the chief petitioner came to you and said, well, I've turned in 140,000 signatures, and I know I haven't got to qualify, but now I want to withdraw it, what would you do today?
Well, as I indicated earlier, I'd have to call the Attorney General's office. I don't have an answer for you today.
Okay.
It would raise the question about what Ms. Olney raised, about whether or not this is out of the chief petitioner's hands now because it's been turned over to the state with more than the threshold amount of signatures, or whether it is something that is still in the chief petitioner's authority. That would be the central legal question.
Just one point, but you never faced this situation, and hopefully you never will.
Yeah, no, in the past, what they've done is just not turned in signatures.
Right.
That's been their way of withdrawing. They haven't done anything formal with us. They just didn't turn in enough signatures, and therefore the whole process stopped.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Buckley. And I would just comment that I couldn't agree with you more, that any time a change to the initiative process is proposed, even contemplated, it does seem to provoke a lot of reaction. And I understand why that is, because this is a process that Oregonians hold very dear, that goes back to the very history of our Constitution. So it's something this committee has obviously worked on a lot last session, and to some extent, I suppose you can tell you did something interesting or important when people bother to challenge it in court. But certainly we're not looking to get into the murky area of questionable constitutionality without knowing what we're doing. So I appreciate your comments today.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I will call Kevin Neely. Good morning. Welcome to the House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules, Part 2.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Neely, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I'm one of those folks, if there were multiple folks, but I'm certainly one of the people that had requested the drafting of this bill. I requested the drafting of this bill on behalf of the district attorneys because we have been, over the course of about 2 years, working on identifying a solution to a significant problem in Oregon, and that's repeat property offenders. In the course of our work, there's been lots of change that has occurred, and lots of barriers that have developed. And I think, in our view, this issue represents yet another barrier. We have and continue to work on overcoming all of these barriers so that we can bring to you and to Oregonians a solution to property crime. It just happens that right now this solution is interfacing with the elections law, which we weren't expecting when we started this process, but after Mr. Mannix turned in his initiative signatures for IP40, it was necessary. We are not, on behalf of the district attorneys, I don't think we're committed to a bill that changes the policy for all initiative petitions, though that's certainly certainly a reasonable discussion for this committee to have, obviously. Our immediate concern is to identify a mechanism by which we think we can respond to the problem that I've already discussed, which is significant repeat property offender problem in our communities, in a way that is economical for the state. In the course of our discussions, we have met with Mr. Mannix, and we have tried to come up with a negotiated settlement that would facilitate him removing IP-40 from the ballot. In addition to that, at least where we are right now, and again, there are still barriers. As I said, this isn't the only barrier. There are other barriers that exist before we'll get to a point of certainty in this process. But we're hopeful that this committee would see to it that we might be able to continue to have these discussions with Mr. Mannix. A very important piece of that discussion is whether or not he does, in fact, have the authority to remove IP-40 from the initiative process. As I said, this has been a process of breaking down barriers. We have worked with many, many groups to try to identify a reasonable solution, and I am hopeful that as you guys work through this bill, we don't dwell upon all of the ways that it's not going to work, and instead we try to find some meaningful ways for this process to work. We think we're going to be able to bring the legislature a reasonable solution to the property crime problem that, when compared to IP-40, saves you hundreds of millions of dollars. And we think it's a good solution for Oregon. And we think that if it's necessary to pass this legislation so that we can make some changes to IP-40, it's worth it. And so, in conclusion, what I would hope this committee is able to do, and there are lots of smart people, some of whom have already spoken, many of whom work for you in your Office of Legislative Counsel and in the Oregon Department of Justice, we're hopeful that you'll work with those folks to try and find a way to come up with a solution that works. And if it doesn't work for all petitions moving forward, we certainly hope we can think about some great solutions for IP-40. If, in fact, this body, the district attorneys, and a number of other people that are working on this issue are able to come to a consensus. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I'm not sure I have a question for you, but I do want to restate what I said earlier, that this bill came forward because I requested it, and I do want to state for the record that I never had a conversation with the district attorneys. Nobody approached me on their behalf asking for this bill, so I'm not sure who was talked to, but it was not the chair of this committee, so just to clarify. Are there any questions for this witness? Please, Representative Thatcher.
Sorry, I was kind of funny the other day. I'm just wondering, and I'm just throwing this out there to any attorneys that may have knowledge of any other court decisions that have taken place besides Mossman, obviously, that might illuminate this conversation, whether it took place here or anywhere, any other state that has a similar law. I'm just wondering if there's any knowledge of any courts weighing in on this issue.
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, I'm not an attorney, and I'm probably not the right person to ask about that. So,
Representative Hunt, did you have a question?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Following up on Representative Shields' question to the previous panel, just to play this out, if in fact we did pass something like this bill, even if it was narrowed specific to IP-40 or this year, just to play it out, if there is a potential constitutional problem and if a signatory to that petition had potential standing in court, wouldn't that be a pretty wild scenario if, in fact, the legislature had passed something, the chief petitioner of IP-40 had withdrawn the measure, and then all of a sudden the measure ended up back on the ballot? Anyway, isn't that kind of a nightmare scenario?
Madam Chair, Representative Hunt, yes. I do think that that's a nightmare scenario, but I think also, as Mr. Lindback stated, this is a process that is that continually has nightmare scenarios. It doesn't seem like there's a single rock you can lift up without having one of those scenarios. And again, I think that for us to get to that point, a number of things would have to happen, clearly. One, we'd have to have legislation passed. Two, Mr. Mannix would have to remove his initiative. And three, an elector would have to challenge it. again, I think that all of those would have to happen in order for there to be litigation, and I don't know that they all would.
Any other questions for this witness? Thank you very much for your comments. Is there anybody else in the room who wishes to testify this morning on House Bill 3604?
Are we going to hear from legislative counsel?
We have legislative counsel in the room, and we certainly can, if there's a request from the members, sure. Okay, so I'll ask legislative counsel to come forward and perhaps give us your thoughts. We at least know you won't be able to say, I'm not an attorney, so... Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Ted Reutlinger from Legislative Council. With me is Gina Zedlick, who is taking over in the elections area from me. And so together we will try to address whatever questions or issues you'd like us to talk about. I'm assuming that at this point you'd like us to just sort of tell you what we think about this issue?
I think that would be great.
Okay. I'll let Gina give that a start.
Hello, members of the committee. My name is Gina Zedlick from the Office of Legislative Counsel. I think as other people have already testified today, we agree that there are some serious constitutional concerns with this bill that have been well articulated, I think, already. So for that reason, I think I'll show you the other side of why we think it could also be defensible. I think that the Constitution is essentially silent on this issue, and so therefore you kind of have to extrapolate from that what the meaning of this could be. So what we did was look at it from both sides. We do think that the Constitution gives a very fairly broad grant of authority to the Legislative Assembly to provide for the manner in which the Secretary of State must verify petitions.
Can you hear me okay?
Okay. And so, you know, the Legislative Assembly has essentially already done that in ORS 250-029, and that's the statute that's amended in the bill. And some people right now agree that that already lines up with what they believe that the Constitution says. However, I think you could also look at that and say and determine that that withdrawal of a petition and when and how you do that is part of the authority of the Legislative Assembly as granted by the Constitution. I think also you can look at... And I think, well, to go along with that, as you know, the bill just aligns the deadline with the already constitutionally set deadline, the final deadline. I think everyone's already talked about this, and I've watched you astutely hit on all the issues that at least we thought of as we went through and looked at this memo, or at this bill. And so, let's see. I think my other... I think I also agree, or we also agree, that the federal litigation that recently happened is fairly irrelevant to this issue. I think our analysis really focused on the Oregon Constitution and Oregon statutes. And let's see. In conclusion, I think that, you know, you've kind of, it is at least defensible under both statute and Oregon Constitution, although I think we completely agree that it's very risky to move ahead with the bill as it is written. I don't know if I articulated that very well, and if Ted has anything to add, can do so.
I would only add...
Would you identify yourself?
I'm sorry, Ted Reutlinger, Legislative Council. Again, we do think it's defensible, at least because the Constitution does give the legislature pretty broad authority to adopt laws that are not inconsistent with Section 1, Article 4, and to adopt laws that specify how the Secretary of State, the manner in which the Secretary of State shall count the signatures. Legislature's already adopted two laws in that respect, one that lets them withdraw the petitions before you file for signature verification, one that allows you to file and then supplement your signatures if the Secretary of State determines that you don't have enough. That leads us to the notion that once you file the petition with signatures, you, the chief petitioner, do retain some degree of control over the petition because you can continue to file even if the Secretary of State says you don't have enough signatures. That's just an example. This bill is aligned with the deadline, as Gina said, for filing signatures. It doesn't allow petitioners to withdraw the petition after the filing deadline. I think that is much very more clearly problematic than this bill. And so if you accept the notion maybe that the chief petitioners retain control up until the deadline, the absolute final deadline, then this bill would be defensible and a court could say, well, okay, we're going to let the chief petitioners control it until the deadline, even if they've already filed it for verification. Finally, I remembered when listening to some testimony that, well, it's not exactly on point, it's analogous, and that's that the Legislative Assembly in one of our five special session years sent a measure or two to the ballot in the first or second special session, and then in the third special session changed its mind, called one of them back, and sent a different one. In that case, the Secretary of State said, wait, you've already sent it. We're obligated under the Constitution to put it on the ballot. And we went to court. We went to the Marion County Circuit Court, where the Legislative Assembly and the Attorney General argued about whether or not we could call that back. And the Marion County Circuit Court ruled a day or two before the election deadline that we did have that power, that we could call that back and put something else on the ballot. So that's, you know, obviously different than the initiative, but at least is, you know, stands for the proposition that maybe things can come back at the request of the people who control them.
Although it would seem to me that a referral from the legislature is quite a different matter from a citizen initiative, because there's been, I mean, clearly the legislature has authority over those referrals. I can't imagine what constitutional issue there could ever be that would take that away. But the issues that have been raised about citizen initiatives are quite a different matter.
Well, yes, Madam Chair, they are different. In this case, I think it was a statute, and so the constitutional authority for the referral and for the initiative flows from the same section of the Constitution. And while you're correct, it is very different because obviously there were no signatures gathered, no individual electors had any sort of vested interest in what the legislature was going to do. So yes, it is different. I'm not sure how powerful that argument is, but it's there as an example.
Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill, as it's written, applies broadly. Is there any difference in your perspective in terms of the potential constitutional challenge to a measure like this that is broad versus a more narrow version that might just apply to this year or to one initiative? My assumption is the constitutional challenges would be the same. It would just narrow the scope of potential litigation down to one instance. Is that a correct assessment?
I believe so. I think that the constitutional issues would probably be the same either way.
Yes, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Yeah, Gina, I'm just going back to a comment you had earlier, saying that as written it would be problematic. Would you suggest other verbiage or change verbiage in this bill to make it less problematic?
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, I didn't mean to imply anything by that particular statement.
Any other questions for Legislative Council? Okay, well, thank you very much. And I understand that this is obviously an evolving discussion, so I think people will continue to think about this after today. Thank you. Members, this obviously what I opened today was a public hearing, and I did want to say that it's unclear what will happen now, that we will certainly continue to discuss this matter. I think there's been great testimony written as well as the testimony we've heard that raised some serious issues about this. My own view would be, I don't know what my view would be at this point. I think we need to take this bill under consideration and give some thought to it. And luckily, I guess for us, and maybe hopefully for the citizens of Oregon, this committee has a little more time than some other committees to deliberate over our work. So at this point, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3604. And members, we do have today, I'll remind you again, it's Super Tuesday, so I'm sure everyone will be well aware of that by this evening when they're watching television. Tomorrow morning, we're lucky enough to have the Secretary of State scheduled to join us for an informational hearing, and our capable committee counsel keeps teasing me by saying all we should have to do to get an audience tomorrow is to set up a television in the room and have people show up and continue to watch C-SPAN or whatever, but I think what we will have is something more meaningful than that. We will be able to have our Secretary of State talking about the elections process and what our situation here in Oregon is, since members remember we did make an attempt, this committee, to move the date of our primary, and that did not happen. So, yes, Representative Berger.
Madam Chair, what time tomorrow?
We are meeting at 8:30 tomorrow morning. And then on Thursday, we are meeting at 8 o'clock, and we do have several resolutions that are scheduled. So, okay.
Great.
Okay, thank you very much. Nothing further to come before us. Committee is adjourned.